Welcome back to TechNet Radio. We're here for part two of our Windows Azure IaaS series, and in this episode, we tackle the top Azure Virtual Machine FAQs and common gotchas. Tune in for this Q&A session and get the answers to some of the most common issues we've seen customers run into. Plus, stick around for a quick demo on how to set up and create your own virtual network. Matt, the mic is yours.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. My name is Matt Hester, and welcome back to our TechNet series on Azure IaaS. Today I have Harry on the phone with us, and we're going to talk about Azure IaaS. Harry, why don't you tell folks a little about who you are, what you do, and what we're going to be talking about today.
Sure, Matt. So my name is Harry. I'm a senior escalation engineer. I work with the Windows Azure technical support at Microsoft. I've been with the cloud computing platform for about 3 years now.
So what that kind of translates to for everybody that's out there is that he gets all your calls about Azure IaaS when things aren't working quite the way that they should. And he was kind enough to join us on the interview today because he actually put together a heck of a FAQ that I'll make sure that will be in the resources for you. You can kind of get answers to some of those common questions. And he and I were talking a bit before we started recording today and talking about, you know, you got this big long FAQ. I think there's like 20 questions on it. But really, what are the top three or four? And I think one that kind of happens, and I've had this happen to me, and I wasn't paying attention to my emails, but it, you know, I had a virtual machine all of a sudden disappear. It just up and disappeared from my Azure IaaS portal, and I couldn't find it. You know, Harry, what's happening there? What's happening when that actually occurs?
So there are two reasons that we have seen that customers ran into this issue because of. One was that, you know, VMs were created using a trial subscription. And each and every trial subscription comes with a specific quotas, right? And if you run into any quotas, you know, we're going to basically, you know, suspend your subscription, and virtual machines will be deleted. Now, we only delete the VMs. All your work and, you know, whatever the changes that you made to the virtual machines are persisted to the storage. So you can basically go back to the storage, and then you can use those VHDs to create a new VMs. Except that, you know, you will lose your whatever the data you put in a temporary drive, that is a D drive. So because of these quotas, you know, you run into issue. I mean, that's the way, you know, the trial quotas are designed. The second reason is, you know, a customer would want to capture a backup of a VM, and they would go and they would use the capture option in the portal, and the capture option is basically intended to create an image, right? So when you capture, and then there is an option that, you know, user has to say that, okay, OS has been generalized. Now, the moment, you know, the user chooses that and then they use the capture option, the VM is gone and the image is created so that the user can create multiple images or multiple VMs based on that image.
So really, there's two reasons. One, you run out of your trial hours, and if you want to avoid that, you can definitely sign up for the pay-for-subscription. And the other one here, if I'm understanding this right, is that you did it yourself. It deleted because you deleted that information, because one of the things he mentioned there, folks, he said generalize. And a lot of you know this as sysprep. And it's essentially what you can do is when you create your virtual machines inside of Azure IaaS, you can actually sysprep them to be used for other purposes. So you can provision other machines that meet a certain footprint or look a certain way very quickly, and when you do that, the one that you happen to sysprep or generalize becomes no longer a system that's running. It becomes a template for other systems that actually run.
Yep, and then to give you just, you know, the little bit of information about the quotas. For example, you know, if a user has subscribed for 90-day free trial, and let's say, you know, they bring up a 4 extra large VMs, and they get to go for 23 hours plus. After that, all the VMs will be deleted.
Yeah, so we recommend, at least I recommend my customers, and I don't know if you concur to this, is that always go to the small. I don't know about very small, but small is what I recommend to most of my customers. If you're just going through the trial and you want to kick the tires, you're probably going to get the most bang of the buck, and you hopefully won't expire until your trial's up with the small virtual machines. Of course, if you stand up 1,000 of them, then all bets are off kind of
thing. Yeah, I mean, you couldn't do more than 4x large VM. So that translates to 24 small. And the other reason the one common thing that we have seen customers doing was that they kind of download some software or they kind of, you know, download the files from the VM to the on-premise. And, you know, every quota, I mean, every trial offer comes with a set of, or I mean, sorry, not set up, comes with a specific outbound transfer. So that means anything that is going out of the data center, we charge them. And depending on the quotas, for example, for 90-day trial, I believe it gives you an option to download about 25 GB. So once you cross 25 GB, download from the VM, then again, you know, the same thing will happen.
Yeah, you won't be able, it'll just kind of go away. Yeah. You mentioned one thing that's interesting to me, and I saw this in the virtual machines the other day, and I was like, okay, what's that doing? When I power up, I made a brand new virtual machine, and inside there I got a D drive, I got a temp drive. What in the world's that for, and can I get rid of it?
So right now, you cannot get rid of the temp drive. The temp drive we have created to use the page file. See, I mean, so for example, let's say, you know, you create a VM. So we persist that, you know, whatever the changes that you make it to the VM. Now, it doesn't make any sense to persist the changes that we make it to page file, right? So we have a temporary drive in there where we put in the files like, you know, page file. I mean, it's really the one file that we put it from the platform. And then, you know, those changes will not be persisted to the storage, thereby, you know, you also avoiding the cost associated with that, right? And in addition to the cost, right, I mean, for example, an application might, you know, have some log files, temporary log files that they want to store. At the same time, you know, they want to get good performance and they want to avoid the cost. They can use this temporary drive. But it's just that, you know, it's very, very important that we cannot store anything that we are not willing to lose on this temporary drive.
So it is a temporary drive. Now, does that account against my quotas as well? So if I have, 90, I think the trial gives you 90 gig of storage. Does the temp drive, what's inside there, count against it as well?
Yes. I mean, so the temp drive, I mean, it comes with a set of, so depending on the size of the VM, that, you know, you get the bigger or smaller temporary storage. That is not, there's no cost associated with that. You just, I mean, that's the limit that you get, but the, we won't charge you. That's max that you can use, that's all.
Okay. So what happens a lot of the times when customers, and this is just something I've learned kind of working with the platform, and it's one of your common questions because it's not something that's obvious, is that, you know, when we go through the process of creating our VHDs and creating our virtual machines up in the actual portal, we actually create, just like we do on a regular Hyper-V installation, we create two files. We create basically a settings file, a virtual machine, and then that's tied to either a virtual disk or virtual hard drives or disks that are all tied to that actual virtual machine. And just like in Hyper-V, if you delete the virtual machine, you don't necessarily delete the disks. And Azure IaaS works exactly the same way, right, Harry?
Yep, absolutely. I mean, so that's one of the common things, right? I mean, that when you create a VM, there are a couple of entities associated with it. There is a base VHD, and then there is a disk or image that you create on top of that VHD, and then there is a VM that you are creating on top of either image or a disk, right? So when you delete a VM, so we don't delete the base VHD or disk or image, right? But if we do that, basically, you know, it's a data loss. Right?
Yeah.
So we only delete the VM object, and then if the customer or user is interested to delete either both the disk and VHDs, there is an option while deleting a disk, you know, they can choose to delete the associated VHD or delete retain the associated VHD. So it's really three steps, you know, when you want to clean up the entire VM with all other resources. First step is basically delete the VM. Second one is, you know, you delete the disks. And the third one is basically ensure that VHDs related to those disks are deleted.
Yeah, and that's what makes sense is a lot of folks, and I don't know if it's just the way the message is written, but even though you deleted the virtual machine, you're still being billed or you're still going to have those trial hours or usage being done because you're still effectively locking up the resources in our data center for those VHD files if you so desire. And I think a lot of people forget about that. It's like, look, yeah, you deleted the virtual machine, but you're still going to be eating up your storage because you're still using our facilities to store your VHD files.
Yeah, I mean, so not only when using a trial quotas, this is important, even when you're paying for it. I mean, we've seen that, you know, some of the customers who are just trying with the IaaS feature of the platform, and they create a lot of VMs and they delete, and then, you know, they would think that, you know, the VHDs are deleted. And at the end of the month, you know, when you get a bill, like, you know, there's a huge bill associated with all your VHDs. So.
Well, it's not funny, but yeah, it's like, wait a second, I thought I deleted all that stuff, and that's really not the case. And then, folks, as you know, hopefully as you should know, that PowerShell is fully supported up there, and there's people that are making – they're actually a fairly simple PowerShell script to do those three processes. You just have to do it in that order, virtual machine, disks, and then the VHD files for those systems. And you can do it simply with the PowerShell script that's inside there. And I think that's one of the hidden gems of Azure is that you can manage the environment with PowerShell, and we have a whole set of commandlets that can work with that. Have you run into any folks that are using a lot of PowerShell in Azure IaaS, Harry?
Oh, so, I mean, we have a lot of IT pros who are using the PowerShell, especially with the latest releases of SDK. We are fully supporting the PowerShell, and PowerShell has become very, very powerful tool to manage the infrastructure today.
Yeah.
I mean, to be really honest with you, there are some other options which are available in PowerShell are not even available in the new HTML5 portal. So.
Yeah.
We do get a lot of customers, you know, who are using the PowerShell. And also there are, like, you know, cross-platform tools out there. There is Azure CLI tool, which is very powerful,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, because we support it, you know, basically, although it's not technically PowerShell, we support it on non-Microsoft OSs. They're going to be managing that environment. I think that's one of the more exciting things when we talk about Windows Azure IaaS is the manageability of it. Yeah, the portal is one way, but really you're going to do a lot of work with PowerShell inside of there. Now, one of the things I've run into, and I think you've had a lot of customers run into, because I know it's on your FAQ and I'm looking at it right now, is whenever we talk about working with Azure IaaS, especially the first time you provision a virtual machine, I always tell people, be patient. Don't try to connect right away. Just let it do its thing. It's going to look like it stopped, but trust me, it's not stopped. Don't restart it. You don't need to force it. It's going to do everything automatically. And what will happen is especially if they try to RDP into it, they have all kinds of interesting things happen to them, but mainly they can't for a little bit. So why don't you talk about some of those issues that happen with the RDP connectivity, especially if they try to connect too soon, and what are some of the other things that you've seen with the RDP connections into the folks?
Okay, so the couple of, the RDP seems to be a fairly popular issue. The customers are connecting to these virtual machines from a different variety of networks. Right, and then we have some issues on the platform due to which, you know, there were some RDP failures in the very beginning stages of the IaaS. Of course, we have covered most of these issues. You know, we fixed them. I believe, you know, by the time that we go GA, we are going to fix all the known issues that are possible with the that are the platform failures. But mainly, I mean, when we are troubleshooting these issues with the customers, we figured that, you know, not all these RDP connection issues are really because of the platform failures. I mean, the customer is trying to connect to a VM and it won't connect, and they get a generic message saying that, you know, unable to connect to this VM. So at that time, I would request the users to just see, are you able to basically go to the outbound of the RDP port? For example, it used to be 3389. But right now, you know, because of the security issues, you know, we have completely randomized that port. So if you were to go to the portal, it will show you the public RDP port on the portal for that particular VM. So take that port and see if you are able to just to get to that port using a simple commands like, you know, telnet or psping.
Yeah.
Tools. And if you're not able to, I would say, you know, just go to so I've seen these issues from a blocked environments where, you know, corporate environments where pretty much they block everything, right? So I would say, you know, you go home or just use the ISP connection and then try to go outbound and see if it works. That tells you it's not a platform issue. It's indeed an infrastructure issue.
Yeah, it's something with your actual, especially with the randomized ports, it could be something that very well happens to somebody's own firewall that are going to prevent that from actually being that kind of traffic from going out. And then really that's because to start with, that's the only way to really get to those systems is with that RDP endpoint that's created by default, unless you start creating other endpoints to try to come into the server that way. But really the RDP is how you have to start.
Yep. And the other commonly very interesting that we've seen customers doing was then in the interest of security, they go and block every ports.
Yep.
And then when that every port means, you know, RDP port is included too. And
yep.
You go to the VM and then you make that changes and you lost the connectivity. You lost the connectivity for good. Because
yep.
The only way that you get to the Windows Azure VM is basically via the RDP. So
yep.
You cannot block that really. I mean,
Yeah, you can't. You have to be. That's your way in, and otherwise you basically effectively have raised all the drawways, all the drawbridges. Effectively raised all the drawbridges and cut all the chains, so people can't even open the drawbridges anymore to the VM. Now, I did see something that was interesting that Michael Washman did around security in those, is that he actually used a PowerShell script to add and remove the endpoint at will, so he could actually move in and out of those systems without having that endpoint kind of always constantly there. So he had his drawbridge, he could drop and lower as he actually needed inside of there. And I think that's kind of an interesting way to approach some of the security that's up there. But, Harry, I get the question, and I'm sure you probably get it as much as I do, if not more. You know what? It's the cloud. It's not secure. I mean, how do you handle those types of things when people start talking about security in the cloud? And from your perspective, how do you talk to customers about that?
Well, I mean, so if the customers are using the PaaS, you know, we have things taken care of on the platform. With this new IaaS feature, one thing that I would like to request our customers is basically they need to start thinking about the security on very, very seriously and also very early stages, because the virtual machines is a so powerful feature. But then with that, powerfulness comes the responsibility of maintaining those VMs. And when I say maintenance, security has to be your biggest aspect there.
Yeah.
So we have seen the customers, the IaaS is in preview, a lot of customers are coming, they just want to try out the virtual machines, but it is their virtual machines when they create, for whether it is for production purpose or test purpose. So, and then we have seen them using very basic passwords like password add one, which ad hacker know this by, I mean, they know this. This is the first one, that you could use those, right? And then if you have the RDP port known, and then, so with those combinations, an attacker can easily get into your machine, and then they can compromise the asset. So security should be one thing that, we at the platform are also making a lot of improvements. If you have seen in the past weeks, if you are to go and give one of the common passwords, we don't allow that password. And
yeah,
also, for RDP, we just completely randomize the port. So we are doing whatever we can at the platform, but IaaS is really the VMs are really the customer's responsibility.
Yeah, and really it's that kind of that same approach to layering of security that we should approach on-premise. We should approach Azure the same way, and Azure just has some additional properties. And then the fact that it's up on the internet, essentially, that when you put things up in there, even though there's no endpoints, how do you prevent something that's in a public environment from not being public? You really can't, but you have to think of it. And I can't stress this enough, and I'm glad Harry brought it up. You got to think of it. Hey, this is a virtual machine, and security should be one of your utmost important things that you do to this Azure system, just like you would on any other system that you expose to the public internet and to making it work with it. You have to make sure you treat it the same way. And a phrase that I've heard a long time ago that always kind of sticks with me is that, cloud don't fix stupid. I mean, if you open up port 135 on your cloud VM, look for fun, because it's not a good day, right? We don't want to open up that port, but that's the kind of stuff that, you got to take that same approach. And I know, Harry, we'll make sure this is in the resources. You wrote a really good article on the security. And when I read it, it was kind of almost a security 101. It's like, make sure you pick a complex password. I mean, it's kind of how it started. And I thought it cracked me up, because like 2 weeks ago, the portal didn't do this. And then last week, the portal started enforcing you can't use common passwords, which is kind of funny, and you'll laugh at this, is because we publish a lot of online labs that people can actually kick the tires for Azure. And we publish the password. So, hey, you stand up a virtual machine, use this password so we can write the doc to support the rest of it. And now it's, hey, pick whatever password you need and just remember it. Have you ever had that customer say, hey, I forgot my password. What do I do? And what's the answer to that?
Well, I mean, so you lost the password, you lost the password. There's no way that there's no way that Microsoft, as Microsoft, we can help you hack the machine. I mean, it's just not possible for Microsoft, not happening. I mean, there might be a lot of tools out there, but there is no way that, we can recover your password, because that's a sensitive matter there, right there.
Yeah.
And also regarding the security aspect, if customers are using virtual networks, I would recommend them to remove the endpoint completely, like you're saying, Matt, Michael Watson's report, sorry, in blog post. So if you're using a virtual network, there is no reason for you to keep that RDP endpoint open. Just get rid of that, and then you can connect between those VMs, because just you're within the same network.
So you talked about a virtual network. Why don't you tell folks a little bit about what that is and why that's important, because it's one of the key security mechanisms. Well, not only that, it's also a key networking concept that we have inside there. Why don't you give people a quick 101 on what the network virtual networks do for us.
Okay. So the virtual networks is basically the feature that allows you multiple computers to be part of under one single network. And also one of the very great benefit that virtual network offers is the site-to-site connectivity. So for example, if you have an on-premise environment, we know that customers cannot migrate to the complete workloads to the cloud at the same time, right? And it takes a bit of time. So what you can do, and then at the same time, you have some cloud entities, you're building up some cloud entities as part of the ongoing efforts, and then you have existing machines that are within your on-premise, and then how do you connect between these? So you can use the virtual network feature, and then you can set up the code name what we use is Brooklyn for this one. So what it essentially does...
Wait. Why Brooklyn? What was the reason? Was somebody in Brooklyn when they thought of it?
I have no clue what that meant, but that's the code name that they use for virtual networks.
Well, and that's kind of like the virtual network for Chicago. We kind of have an idea where they were, but Brooklyn, come on, there has to be some reason. Maybe the Brooklyn Dodgers. We'll come up with some story by the end of the radio interview.
So what Brooklyn allows is basically site-to-site connectivity, and then some of the amazing things for this one is, for example, if you have your own Active Directory on the on-premise environment and you want your machines, the cloud machines, to talk to that particular Active Directory, you can do that. Or if you actually want to set up your Active Directory within the Windows Azure virtual network and then have that connected to your other machines which are on-premise, you can do that too. So the virtual machines and the other security aspect that I said, right, you get rid of all the endpoints that you have and then establish the connections only within internally, and which is an amazing thing for the customer. So we have seen a lot of enterprise customers using that already. They get rid of all the endpoints and then they just communicate between the machines via VPN, just like they would how you would VPN to your corporate environment.
So essentially, they're keeping even though they're up in a public area like Azure, they're keeping them kind of locked away, so they're not going to be publicly exposed. Now, if somebody wanted to turn that into the web server and actually make that a public facing, that's where they have to come back in and re-enable some of those endpoints. Correct?
Yep.
Okay.
That's right.
Awesome. So when we talk about the virtual networks, I mean, one of the things that's interesting to me is depending on how you're doing this, don't you need some specialized hardware under the covers to make all that work as well?
So I think there are a couple of compatible. That's right, Matt. And so there are. I'm not exactly sure about the list. I mean, there is a Cisco, and then there is a Juniper. I guess they have some of the compatible routers. And now what we really say is not. I mean, we're not going to say, okay, so these are the compatible routers. All we're going to say is, okay, these are the requirements. And then and as long as your equipment can do that requirements, it's really you're really welcome to use those. And when you run into issues, we will not be able to help you with that particular hardware, right? I mean, because we're not the experts there. So basically, we request the vendors of that particular hardware to be involved, in troubleshooting those issues.
Yeah. So they're consistent. So one of the things, I'm going to have Harry actually show us the creation of a virtual network here and actually kind of have you step through the process, Harry, and just show people kind of what's there and what's powerful and kind of the beginnings of, even though there's a lot of other things that have to happen to maybe connect Active Directory or connect anything on-premise, it kind of starts and stops with virtual networks. So Harry, why don't you go ahead and show folks how that works?
Sure. Okay, so on the left, so this is the management portal that all of our customers are used to. So you have the network option here. Using which you will be able to create a virtual networks. So you have a bunch of options like quick create option and custom create option, and then register local network and all. So let me show you a little bit of the my networks here. So I have like domain VNet and then Skynet, and these are the virtual networks that I created, and these are the local networks. That means it's my corporate or on-premise environment details and their IP addresses and their ranges and what is the VPN gateway address of my on-premise environment, using which I establish you can establish the site-to-site connectivity.
And these are essentially that local network is the endpoint for lack of a better word, it's actually the endpoint or the connectivity channel to my actual on-premise environment.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
And this is the gateway that using which, you know, all the traffic goes through. So it's just not, I mean, it's pretty much like, I mean, nothing but a VPN connection.
Okay.
And this is a VPN endpoint, right? And the creating a virtual machine, virtual network is pretty easy here. Let me just do a custom create. I mean, let me do a sort of custom create. So you just give it a name. And then, you know, you need to specify an affinity group. I mean, beforehand, you know, you would go to the networks and then, all right, let me show you the...
I think this is one of the portal things they just changed. It's under settings now.
Right, it's under settings.
Yeah, Harry and they changed the portal in the beta on quite a bit on us. So, folks, it's a live demonstration, so these are always fun to do.
Well, I mean, so at the blink of an eye, you know, we have the features coming and going, and then I've seen a lot of additions into the portal in the last couple of weeks.
It's grown up, yeah.
So, I know you just give it pick up a name for your affinity group. So affinity group is basically just nothing but, you know, you want to make sure all your cloud entities, you know, sit kind of together or, you know, if possible within a given cluster. So I'm going to say affinity group one, and then you can choose which region that all you want this cloud resource to be in. So yeah. I'm going to choose, you know, West US Create here. And I already have a couple of affinity groups that I can use for this network demo. So let me go and go back to my custom screen here. And then these are the affinity groups that I have created. So this is going to be creating in the virtual West US data center. And here's the address space that you can specify for all the VMs that you will be adding to this particular the virtual network. And here, you know, we have two formats. One is the count. So you just, you know, choose the starting IP and then, you know, mention the count here. And the CIDR format is really the format, you know, used across the IT industries.
Yep.
So you choose these ones, and one thing I want to call out is then, you know, the right now, as of now, you know, it's completely optional to give a subnet here. So if you do leave the subnet here, we're going to choose by default by 29. That means every VM that you create, you know, it's going to eat up eight IPs.
Okay.
So, for example, you know, if you were to create a subnet or address space with a count of 16 VMs,
yeah,
and then you know you create two VMs, your allocation is done.
Oh wow!
Because you know you didn't specify the subnet. I think you know so. In going forward, I think you know maybe you know there might be portal guys might add a feature where you know subnet is a must. So that you have better control. So I would say, you know, just don't ignore the subnet. You know, go ahead and give the subnet so that you have you have the tighter control over the subnets now.
Okay, awesome.
And that's it. And then you specify your, you know, DNS server, which DNS server that you want to, you know, your VNs to be connected to, and then you're good to go.
And when that DNS server, basically, you're telling it which DNS server in your Azure IaaS or which server in your Azure IaaS server is going to act as the DNS server, correct?
So it could be that, or you can actually specify a DNS server on top of, you can just refer to your on-premise DNS server.
As long as we have that local network set up so the requests actually have someplace to go.
Yeah, that's right. We have seen a lot of enterprise customers, you know, they want to use the DNS from their on-premise because that's the way they're using for all their, all the virtual machines and the physical machines. So
yep,
they're free to use that, you know, public DNS server here. It just has to be publicly accessible.
So that's kind of an interesting thing. They look very easy to create, but they're a very powerful thing that we have to create so we can actually secure the access. And then once you do these things and we have that site-to-site VPN set up, we can essentially get rid of the RDP endpoint, not have to worry about that endpoint at all, especially if those servers are just going to do internal processing for whatever that application is making it happen, correct?
Yep, absolutely right. I mean, so like I said, right, I mean, security couldn't be more important than ever. I mean, when you're in the cloud and then your VM is accessible on the public,
yep,
in public environment, you need to be very critical about that, and security is one of the top things. And majority of our enterprise customers are already using the virtual networks and then getting rid of those public endpoints so that nobody else outside their their work environment, you know, can connect to those particular VMs.
Yeah, and the best thing about it is if they need that endpoint back in, maybe to run up and do something else on the server, if they can't get to it with VPN, they can always add that endpoint back in fairly easily and then remove it when they're done.
Yep. And then on the dashboard, virtual network dashboard, you know, it really shows you you can use this for a lot of troubleshooting purposes, you know, when you have, for example, when you're trying to set up a site-to-site connection and then and then something goes wrong, you can use this portal. I mean, as of now, you can see that, you know, my VPN is trying to connect to the local network here. That's because, you know, these VMs are actually being this particular network, you know, I've set it up using Windows Server 2012, acting as a gateway. That's not yet supported. I'm not sure if it's going to be supported in the future, but that's something, you know, we wanted to investigate and then just try and get our hands dirty, and we were successfully able to connect. But now, you know, that gateway machine is basically shut down. That's why now, you know, this it shows right here, and it's trying to connect. I mean, connect.
Yeah.
Right. And this is the gateway IP address.
Well, I was thinking when I see Skynet, I'm thinking that the end of the world just happened as we're doing this radio interview, and we just don't know about it yet, you know, because it became cognitive, right? I mean, Skynet, you know, became real and became intelligent and wants to get rid of us all. And Arnold Schwarzenegger is going to save us all, right?
I mean, I kind of picked the wrong word. I think I just said that's not the Skynet. I meant to say that, you know, my network is in the sky right now. I'm in the cloud.
I know. I'm simply saying that's when I think Skynet, I'm thinking Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I know.
So that was awesome, Harry, getting to show us kind of the basics of the virtual network and kind of the beginnings of being able to connect that and talk about a lot of the common things that you have. You know, I'm going to make sure people see your fact because it's awesome. But do you have any last parting comments or questions for the folks listening to this this podcast?
One of the popular questions that we get is that, you know, when this IaaS will go to GA, because there are a lot of customers really want to move their production workloads there. So as with any other features, basically, unless we make it public, we do not have any information to share. But what I can tell you is, you know, when I'm closely working with my resources and internal teams here, and everybody, the IaaS is one of the top priorities. They want to get that in the market like as early as possible. I wouldn't be even surprised, you know, if we go to GA this month, right?
Yeah.
I just want to say, you know, it's going to be soon enough, and just
soon.
You know, stay
close. Yeah, well, and that's one of the things about it. We don't, you know, Harry and I don't know. We have general ideas when we think it's going to happen, and we hope it happens in those dates. But, folks, one of the great things about this, we know when it's baked, you guys are going to get your hands on it. We hope that you look forward to taking advantage of it. And definitely you want to check out Harry's FAQ and his also security information about how to keep those things secure. So, Harry, I want to say thank you for taking time out of your busy day to come out and talk to us about Azure IaaS, and thank you to all for tuning in. Thank you and have a great day.